Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 18th, 2008, and I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Our first segment tonight is going to be Money and Markets, where we discuss traditional or modern portfolio theory and its application under current market conditions. Then we're going to move to Ask Catherine and respond to a subscriber's question about the amount of U.S. debt outstanding. For movers and shakers, we are delighted that we're going to be joined by investigative reporter John Rappaport, and then that will be followed by the Let's Go to the Movies segment, and this week it's one of my all-time favorites, as anybody knows me knows, Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. So let's dive right into money and markets. Modern portfolio theory, or what I sometimes call traditional portfolio theory. What is it? It's many things if you really want to dive into all the analytics and the academic part of it. But what modern portfolio theory says is that an investor can use diversification to reduce their risk, and by doing so can optimize portfolio performance through different cycles in the economy. And the idea is to invest in a broadly diversified portfolio of assets, and that way the performance of one class will differ from the performance of others, and you're looking for asset classes that are countercyclical or not correlated to each other. So for example, when the information technology or the technology stocks are up, maybe utilities are not doing so well, and when utilities are doing well, then the internet and technology stocks are doing well is kind of the gist of it. And so this idea of diversification also leads to another recommendation, which says don't time markets, don't try and get in and out of different, or don't try and time the market, just stay in this broad diversified group of assets and live through the cycles, the up and down of the business cycle. So the economy goes down, it goes up, and you just stay in through the cycles. Now, this theory has been used over the last year or two to persuade investors that they should stay in the stock market and the financial markets, and they should leave their retirement savings invested in, for example, the stocks and bonds of large financial institutions, because that is part of a diversified group of categories. Now, I believe that modern portfolio strategy is a very useful tool. However, the current application leaves a great deal to be desired, and I want to go through that tonight and tie that back to the stories that we've been posting at the blog on money and markets. First, let's talk about diversification. Real diversification is a great thing. The reality, though, is that most stocks, corporate stocks and bonds, particularly that a U.S. investor is buying, are not truly diversified in the way that they might have been 20 or 30 years ago. If you dig into the financials of many large corporations, and certainly now many large banks, what you find is that these are companies that are deeply dependent on federal government purchases, on federal government contracts, and now even more federal government bailouts. And so, in fact, they're not in different industries. They're very much a credit of the U.S. government and the U.S. government's ability to borrow more money. And so the issue of how much debt the U.S. really has outstanding is very pertinent to an analysis of how strong these companies are, because they're so dependent on the government being able to borrow more money. Now, that's corporations. Let's look at state and local government, and we're going to find the same thing. What you'll find is when you dig into the financial statements and the balance sheets of many counties and towns and certainly state governments, their finances are very intertwined with the federal government and, again, deeply dependent on the federal government's ability to borrow more money. And then another category in many portfolios, in addition to corporate stocks and bonds and municipal bonds, is bank CDs or other sort of paper from financial institutions, which again are dependent on FDIC insurance. and significant provision now of loans from both the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And then finally, of course, you have agency and Treasury securities. So it is not an unusual thing for me to look at a portfolio that has, through the mutual funds, thousands and thousands of corporate stocks and bonds, municipal bonds, bank CDs and other bank securities, and federal agency and Treasury securities. And what I'm looking in at with all those thousands of stocks and bonds is essentially one security, and that is the creditworthiness of the U.S. Treasury to be able to borrow more money and the Federal Reserve to print more money. And so it's not diversification. So if we're going to apply modern portfolio theory to your portfolio, what we need to think about is how do we achieve true diversification, particularly when we look under the rug. And so the moral of the story is diversification is a wonderful thing, but in a world where the economy has become this centralized, how do you achieve real diversification? So that's issue number one. Second issue that really informs the application of modern portfolio theory is the market a market or is it an economic warfare battle zone? I mean, you've heard me say last week and certainly in all the radio shows and events that I do saying the stock market is no longer a market, it's become an economic warfare battle zone. So let me give you some reasons why I believe this. First, we have, over the last decade, the government and the central banks intervening, not just in the U.S., but throughout G8, in the markets in extraordinary and dramatic ways, not just in the bond markets, but in the currency markets, in the stock markets. And this is becoming more and more overt, and certainly with the bailouts, it's become extremely overt. The process means that different large financial institutions are acting as the agent for the government. I mean, the government needs somebody who can execute these interventions. And so we see, for example, the emergence of a group of banks in New York who are New York Fed member banks who are literally in the market and have access to extraordinary inside information because they are trading on behalf of, for example, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is in essence, a slush fund managed by the New York Fed for the benefit of the Secretary of the Treasury and reporting to the Secretary of the Treasury. This means that you have a group of insiders who have extraordinary inside information that the rest don't have and who are operating with the benefit of Treasury and central bank support. So when they lose money, there's a bailout waiting for them, but when we lose money as investors, there's no bailout waiting for us. And this is a situation of highly managed markets, not markets in the sense contemplated by traditional portfolio theory. So issue number one, government central bank intervention. Two, and perhaps even more important, we're looking at extraordinary levels of fraud. If you haven't looked at the posts on our blog about naked short selling, I recommend them to you. But essentially, naked short selling is a process where the large players in the financial system can drive down the values of the smaller companies in any sector in a way that has nothing to do with their performance. It's flat-out economic warfare. It's fraud that makes money for the fraudsters and harms the really productive parts of the economy. And that's been permitted to happen. We see naked short selling as one of many examples, but we see the absence of significant enforcement. If you got on the call early, you heard John and I talking about the Bernard Madoff story. We have an old line family firm in New York now announced that they have lost $50 billion in a running Ponzi scheme for, say, almost two decades. That could not happen without institutional support at high levels and with the enforcement agencies standing down. I mean, the notion that one head of a firm can run a double set of books on an operation that complicated for that long is absurd. So we have a pattern of absence of enforcement. Debt overhang. I was in Estonia several weeks ago and had lunch with some money managers from Munich in Tallinn, which is the capital of Estonia. They said to me, oh, you know, the shakeout's over. It's time to go back in. There are incredible opportunities in the equity markets. Because the price of all the equity on the planet is very much related to how much the debt overhang is. And they said, don't you agree with us? And I said, absolutely not. I think this shakeout has just begun. The debt overhang is much greater than anyone knows, and proceeded to go through my different writings about mortgage fraud and why I believe there's significant collateral fraud in both the treasury market, treasury security market, in the government mortgage market, and then the straight mortgage market, including Fannie and Freddie. They turned white and said that they were heading back to Germany and Latvia to redo their charts. So with this level of fraud, you're looking at a world of, again, economic warfare, and not the world of markets that was contemplated by modern portfolio theory. Modern portfolio theory assumes a certain level of integrity within the market. Now, one of the things that most concerns me is that a lot of this kind of fraud is going to be used as a justification that we need more regulation. It is true in some areas that we could use some changes in regulations. We could use the ability to enforce and regulate derivatives. We could bringing down Glass-Steagall was a terrible idea. It would pay to bring it back up. However, the problem over the last 10 or 20 years has not been that we didn't have the laws on the books. It was the enforcement was selective. So, for example, as I've written in Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, enforcement was used to drive the honest people out and to help engineer the housing bubble. Or in naked short selling, we've seen an incredible stand down of enforcement. In the suppression of the gold market, same thing. We've seen an incredible stand down of enforcement. We've certainly seen across the board in industry after industry a failure to enforce antitrust. So the laws have been on the books, and enforcement has been used in selective ways that support the centralization of the economy, giving the people who are centralizing the economy more power and more regulation is not necessarily going to change anything. It could make things worse. So the bottom line is, with the absence of these basic standards, the question is an economic warfare battleground an appropriate place for retirement savings during a shakeout? Now, there are two other points I just want to touch on. One is that several years ago, Warren Buffett was griping about derivatives and said something to the effect of, derivatives are the equivalent of financial weapons of mass destruction. What I've learned in talking with people about that comment is that many people do not really understand the magnitude of what Buffett was saying. What Buffett was saying is that five derivative portfolios, or I would bring it down to five derivative portfolios, because one thing to understand about the derivative market is it's unbelievably centralized here in this country among a small group of the New York Fed member banks. So J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank. So it's several very large portfolios at a few banks. My theory is, again, that they're acting as an agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund and the government. So exactly who bears the liabilities is not particularly clear. But what Buffett was saying was this, or what I want you to think about is this. If I'm the president of a company that possibly some of the people on this call are investing in, and I have stock, so I have equity, which represents ownership in the economic value of my company, the value of my stock in today's market is not determined by the what a financial course in a business school will teach you, which is the present value of your future cash flows. Instead, it's determined by the supply and demand for capital, as is determined by five derivative portfolios that I have no influence on, I can't control, and the government doesn't regulate. So five players can put together derivative portfolios which can completely control and determine my price, the price of my equity, my ability to raise capital, and even the success or the survival of my company in a way that is completely outside my control, which means that five banks can essentially drop a nuclear bomb on almost every company in the economy, and there's nothing those companies can do. And that means we've given, we've created a level of risk controlled by a tiny few players that can literally bomb the whole market and determine prices across the board. So that the existence of the derivative market as it currently is constructed takes modern portfolio theory and just throws it out the window, because again we're in an environment that was never contemplated by that. Finally, I just want to say briefly that there's a difference between a business cycle and a financial coup d'etat. And what I believe we're going through is a fundamental reengineering of governance and ownership of assets on planet Earth, not just in the United States, but it's been going on around the world. We're going to talk a lot more about that next week. And so this is not a traditional business cycle. This is something else. And staying in the market in this kind of environment, when it's not a cycle, it's something else. It has a whole level of risk never contemplated by modern portfolio theory. Now, let's just turn to a couple stories on the blog that really bear on this. I wrote earlier this year about the Dodge and Cox losses on Fannie Mae. Dodge and Cox is a very respected San Francisco money manager, and when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the mortgage market crashed, they did a significant analysis of what was going on and took a position of over $1 billion. They bought into Fannie Mae as the stock dropped and then absolutely got slaughtered when the government took over Fannie Mae, lost about $1 billion. Now, the thing that's amazing about this is it says that Dodge and Cox really had no idea, despite all their intelligence and all their research, about the level of fraud in the mortgage market and in the world of government right now in Washington, that they were naive about what was really going on. Another big story over the last week has been Broken Strategy, the fall of Bill Miller, and it's about Bill Miller, who until a year ago was one of the most successful value investors. Very similar story to Dodge and Cox. As the financials drop, he bought in thinking we were at the bottom, didn't begin to even understand the amount of fraud in the mortgage system or the debt overhang, and is down 58% as of the writing of the story. So both times you have examples of very capable, very astute, very hardworking, very responsible investors who've been absolutely taken by surprise by the level of fraud. Now, one of the interesting things about these stories is our opportunity. I talk about this a lot in the Position Your Assets audio seminar. One of the great opportunities over the next decade or two are companies and places, because it's going to be both communities and companies that offer real solutions to the financial issues and the economic issues that need to be addressed and that we face. And flowing capital and attention and support to those efforts is not going to happen until a broad section of the people who are interested in finance and money and the allocation of investment in the society start to understand the real problems. And my hope of what could come out of, you know, the Bill Millers and the Dodge and Coxes understanding the real problems is that we could start to see some very significant talent in the financial community start to understand what the real problems are and so see the real solutions and start to flow time, attention, and capital to those sectors. And if that could happen, there could be, you know, there could be a some lemonade in the lemon of Bill Miller's 58% losses. So that's it on money and markets for this week. But I would encourage you, if you've got people in your life who are telling you that traditional portfolio theory applies, I'd love for you to digest this again. That we're going to post the MP3 on your subscriber panel, and I want you to really think about explaining to them that modern portfolio theory is a thing of beauty, but no, it doesn't apply because the assumptions that it's predicated on are very different than what we're watching in the world today. Okay, ask Catherine. We had a subscriber ask a question that's near and dear to my heart. How much U.S. debt is really outstanding? And let me just read you what he said. He said, financial expert Max Keyser discussing the bailout on Al Jazeera says that the U.S. has some $500 trillion in non-collateralized bonds. Others argue there is $1.5 quadrillion in derivative trading contracts outstanding. Just how much debt is outstanding, and what effect will this have on the global markets and the price of gold and silver despite central bank manipulation? And how do we actually know how much debt there is? Well, here's the truth. No one knows. The federal government for 13 years now has been required by law to produce audited financial statements, and it hasn't done it. So we know that Paul O'Neill, when he was Secretary of the Treasury, made an effort to produce a study to show how much debt was outstanding. They put it up on the web. They took it down right away. And the next thing you know, Paul O'Neill and the National Economic Advisor were fired. So the truth is we really don't know. What I believe is that the debt levels of Treasury securities, government agency securities, and other positions that the government is liable for, including whatever trading has been done on their behalf by the New York Fed member banks for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or any other aspect of the financial implementation of national security, is many multiples of what is in the official balance sheets. If you read my story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits at dunwalkie.com, you can link from my homepage, or my article, The Myth of the Rule of Law, I get into the details of why I believe that the collateral fraud in the mortgage markets is significant. If you look at our missing money page for all the money missing from the federal government at various times, it'll touch on why I think also the same goes for Treasury securities. So when Max says that there may be, you know, trillions or quadrillions of debt or derivatives that have been issued off balance sheet for which the government is liable for, what I would tell you is that's absolutely possible. The story this week that has really caught my attention both last week and this week is the Bloomberg versus the Fed. Bloomberg, which has done some of the best financial reporting on the bailouts, tried to get the Fed to disclose the collateral that they were taking for $2 trillion, just let me say that again, $2 trillion of loans. If you want to know where the real bailout action is, it's not at the Treasury, which is only $700 billion. It's at the Fed, which now is in the many trillions. So Bloomberg submitted a FOIA to the Federal Reserve, a FOIA is a Freedom of Information Act request, asking for disclosure of what was the collateral that the Fed was taking, and the Fed has refused to disclose it. And so now Bloomberg has filed a motion in support of their FOIA to try and force the Fed to disclose what collateral. My theory on what is happening is the Fed can't possibly disclose what the collateral is because the Fed can't possibly afford the market to know that the kind of collateral we're taking is full of collateral fraud. If anything, the collateral may be non-existent. So the Fed cannot afford for the system to understand how bad it is. And so the Fed has, if all of us were at the Fed tomorrow and we disclosed what was really going on, that would, if for those of you who know my red button story, that would really push the red button. And that's important because one of the things the Fed is grappling with is the fact that the interbanking market has seized up because nobody trusts each other. So the more you disclose how the extent of the fraud, and again, what I believe is that it's far more extensive than anybody really most players really understand or know. But the more it discloses how extensive it is, the more dangerous it is that the market's going to seize up. Now, the solution to the Fed's problem in disclosure gets us to another very top story this week, and that is that the Fed has cut interest rates on Fed funds to a historic low of 0 to 0.25%. So now they don't have to disclose collateral because the banks can just come in and get as much money as they want for 0%. Now, what all of this means with this much debt outstanding is that the pressure on the current government officials to inflate their way out of the debt problem is going to continue, and it's going to result in a real premium being placed on controlling and owning real assets. So when you think about diversification in your portfolio, you really want to think about real assets and where are the real assets and the networks that can make a real difference to you. Okay, so let's turn to movers and shakers. As any of you who know me know, first of all, let me just say, health problems are one of the most significant causes of financial problems. So you can't divorce any conversation about building personal or family wealth without, you know, in the same breath, talking about and dealing with how we build and maintain personal and family health. And in this environment, that's a lot more complex than I ever believed it is. One of the things I'm consistently concerned about with myself, my family, my friends, my network, the Solari Network, is that we are underinvesting our time and money in preventative health care and in understanding what is really going on in the world and in the economy that affects our health. Now, I once had somebody come to me and say, I really want to understand how the system works, both the covert system and the overt system. I want to understand how the world works at a deeper level. What should I do? And I said, what you should do is you should read everything that John Rappaport ever wrote, and then you should come back and talk to me. John has been an investigative reporter for many decades now. There is no one who has committed themselves and gone at figuring out a map of our world with more integrity than John Rappaport. And one of the areas he's looked into the most, he's looked into many areas, so we can talk with John about many things, but one has been the health and the medical area. So I wanted to start our conversation with John in that area. And before I just introduce him, the last thing I want to say is probably the most riveting presentation in my life that I've ever seen was at a offshore conference in Cancun, and John had been asked to speak about a number of topics, but one of them with bird flu. And he got up and basically explained why bird flu was a bunch of hooey. And it took my breath away. So, John, are you with us?
I am.
So let's start with vaccines, John, because that your presentation that night really focused me on the dangers of being tricked into thinking I need a vaccine shot for these various ills that plague us.
I've got exactly 15 minutes, so I'm going to pack a lot of stuff into this.
Okay.
All right. First of all, everything I'm saying is as a reporter. I'm not a doctor. I'm not giving you medical advice. I'm just telling you what I've discovered. All vaccines are based on the premise that somehow if you can stimulate the immune system or a part of the immune system to react as if a real disease was present when it isn't present, in other words, a sort of a dress rehearsal, then when the real disease germs come along, the body is going to have some kind of memory of the dress rehearsal and is going to come out on stage and do battle and win. That's the whole basis of what vaccines are supposed to do. And my conclusion is that that is ridiculous because The immune system is many more things than the antibody reaction to a vaccine, because that is the way vaccine effectiveness is measured. Do we have antibodies stirring in the immune system? Antibodies are these messengers that go out and kind of identify potential invaders, germ invaders. But unfortunately, the immune system is so much more than that. It's the skin, it's the blood, it's the brain, it's the emotions. It is the condition of the intestinal system. It is the nutritional level of support that what one eats is giving the body. It's so many different things. And what I've done is document many cases where vaccines were given to a population in a certain local area, and then, for example, you would get an outbreak of the very disease among people who were vaccinated, that the vaccine was supposed to prevent from happening. I've discussed situations, and this is a little bit more subtle, where you have a vaccine being given, and then the disease against which the vaccine is aimed does not occur in any great proportion anymore, but instead people begin to get sick from something that nobody understands. And of course, nobody goes back and dares to make a connection or possible connection to the vaccine, so it goes by the boards. You have documented ingredients in vaccines such as mercury and formaldehyde and various other chemicals, to say nothing of germs, that can be injurious directly to the body. And a number of vaccines are made or cultured in animal products, such as eggs and so forth, where the random germs that are contained in the vaccine can never be completely eliminated. And the vaccine is given directly as an injection and therefore automatically bypasses a number of defense systems within the immune system and can get right into the blood and vital organs. Therefore, it's not really a very good idea at all to be courting various kinds of animal germs that are not being filtered out by certain layers in the immune system. So those are just a few of the problems that I came across when I started investigating vaccines. And then I began to ask, do we have a good controlled study for any vaccine that has ever been given that follows up on a population which was vaccinated versus a population that has not been vaccinated? And we have followed large numbers of people over a period of, let's say, 5 to 10 years and seen what the outcome is. And the other requirements for such a study would be that these two populations, the control group and the vaccinated group, would have similar levels of health, which is to say, for example, nutritional status, immune indicators, immune system indicators at the beginning of the study, and so forth and so on. And as far as I can tell, the answer is no. There has never been a really legitimate controlled study of the kind that I'm talking about to confirm or deny the fact that a particular vaccine is effective. And yet, this is supposed to be one of the most basic tenets of modern medical science, that vaccines have been confirmed as wonderful eliminators, preventatively speaking, of disease. And so that kind of, in a nutshell, a very fast nutshell, is a reason that I have spent a great deal of time over the years exposing this information to the public through articles and tapes and so forth, so that people can make up their own minds about whether or not to take vaccines or to give them to their children. And I'll conclude this by saying that no studies of vaccines of any kind, of any duration, have ever taken into account the fact that now in this country we have recommended numbers of different vaccines for very young children that are coming up into the high 20s of different kinds of shots that are administered either at the same time or in close proximity to one another, and therefore have a very serious potential of cumulative negative effect on the body. And the number of these Centers for Disease Control recommended vaccines is moving upward all the time. So therefore, the problems that I've sketched out so far don't get better, they get worse. So that should give you some pause for thought.
Are we ready to go into water?
Sure, why not?
Well, one of my biggest bugaboos is the importance of fresh food and fresh water. And I'm deeply suspicious of the chemicals that get put into municipal water supplies. I live on a well and have a whole house filter, and I just got back from Philadelphia staying with a friend who is getting municipal water, and the difference was incredible. So I thought maybe we could touch on fluoride and chlorine and the chemicals that get put into water.
Yes, I'll discuss chlorines very briefly and then go on to fluoride. You will find European countries that have outlawed the widespread use of chlorine. All you have to do is Google it and take a look and you'll see. That information is not readily transmitted in the American press. That's because this chemical is toxic. It's highly toxic. And, of course, it works to kill off things that are in the water, but that doesn't make it a good chemical. I mean, one of the easiest things to do is to kill things. You know, I could probably go into my kitchen and without any knowledge whatsoever find a few things and mix them up and put them into water, and I could kill germs. Big deal. That doesn't mean that I'm going to turn around and drink the water. All right. When we come to fluorides, what I'm looking at here is an article from the New Life Journal dated October 1, 02, which is a statement by William Hirzy, H-I-R-Z-Y, who is a member of the Environmental Protection Agency Professionals Union, opposing fluoridation of water.
Well, that's a brave man.
Yeah, that's a brave man, and it's also a very undercovered media story. I mean, wouldn't you think if you were running a newspaper that you would want to splash a headline across the front page, EPA opposes fluoridation as dangerous? I mean, that would be a sensational story.
Yeah.
But you don't see that. I'm just going to read a couple of quick things from his statement. First of all, here's the article. This is not Hirzy talking. Why did a labor union that represents professional employees at the headquarters of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency vote to oppose putting fluoride in drinking water? Okay. Now, here's one of the things that Hirzy says. He's talking about the union opposition to fluoridation. He said, we tried to settle the issue quietly within the family, but EPA management stonewalled us. We took the fight public with a union brief in a lawsuit filed against the EPA by a public interest group over the issue. Obviously, did no good. All right. So he talks about some of the hazards of fluoridation: acute toxic hazards, such as to people with kidney function, as well as chronic toxic hazards of gene mutation, cancer, reproductive effects, neurotoxicity, bone pathology, and dental fluorosis, which in effect is the decay of teeth, ironically enough. And then he says another troubling brain effect has recently surfaced: fluoride's interference with the function of the brain's pineal gland, which is a very significant part of the body's system of operation. So here is somebody on the inside, somebody who is part of environmental protection, who's a member of a union, and the union opposes fluoridation, and yet nobody hears about this. So I offer that as a word to the wise. And I don't have the time to discuss all of the proactive things that you can do in your community, but the first thing you can certainly do is to find out whether your water is fluoridated or not. And there are many good articles, many good websites you can find about fluoridation, including a really knockout article about the Manhattan Project that was nuclear, but had the side effect, so to speak, of creating huge amounts of fluorides and the effects of those over the years in places like New Jersey and Delaware. So, again, that should give you some pause for thought.
Who's that story by, John?
One of the authors of the nuclear story, you mean?
Of the Manhattan Project story.
Yeah. His last name is Griffiths, I believe, with an S at the end, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H-S. I spoke with one of these guys some years ago. He was very good. I think you can find it easily if you just throw in a few keywords on Google.
I think the hardest thing for most people to understand when you first look at the truth behind vaccines or the chemicals in the water or numerous other health issues, you know, one we won't talk about today, but which is a big one for me, is genetically modified food. And they can't fathom that this could be going on a widespread basis without them knowing or having heard about the problems and the dangers and the risks. You know, it's hard to believe that it's that bad. Of course, once you face that, then of course you can really start to take action. And if you do, there are significant improvements you can make. And so maybe let's turn to the immune system, because I think, you know, one of your important messages is if you have a strong immune system, you can deal with lots of these things.
Yes. In about the 3 minutes I have left, I'll do that. Here's the clue. As Catherine has just said, if your immune system, your body defense system, so to speak, and the immune system, when you really look at it in its totality, is even more than a defense system. It's just what you could call a health maintenance and expansion system. If that's operating well, then you will have far fewer problems, health problems, in general. So your first priority should be that. Good nutrition. Supplementation, if you need it, and most people do, with good quality nutritional supplements. Not all companies manufacture great nutritional supplements. Exercise. An outlook about your future in which you are creating what it is that you want rather than trying to fit in within society's rules and regulations, because the mind-body connection is very real and very strong. And once you have established a strong immune system, many problems do not visit you. They just don't. The ones that do, you stand a much better chance of taking care of than other people do. And along with that, and this is my last point, recognize that the medical system as a whole has a kind of covert function, which is to involve you in it, to get you into the system, as they say on the cop shows, in such a way that when a doctor gives you a drug, that drug will, whatever else it does, create new symptoms, which will then be diagnosed as something separate and apart with a label that supposedly has nothing to do with the drug that you just took, and then you will get new drugs. And those new drugs will do the same thing to you, so that if you look at the profile of a person who's been in the system for 10 or 15 years, you see immediately from the numbers of drugs they are taking and the documented adverse effects of those drugs that they are in a serious health situation and are in decline, heading downhill. And the longer they then depend upon the very system that produced this to get them healthy, the closer they move to exiting from the planet. That is the map of what happens to people who get thoroughly ensconced in the system. And I've seen this firsthand. I've seen it repeated over and over again. I've discussed it in various ways in my articles. And this is something that you need to be aware of. Most of the drugs that are prescribed for people in this country are, by my research, in my opinion, completely unnecessary. And they have adverse effects. So we are in the middle of a toxic system. And toxicity accumulates and creates all manner of health problems. And those problems are given convenient disease labels by doctors who then prescribe more toxic chemicals to treat them. So on that lovely holiday note, I will conclude.
I wanted to mention a few things before you go. One is I have a nutritionist who I think is a healer of tremendous power. And her name is Dr. Laura Thompson. She's going to be joining us next month, and she happens to be your wife.
Yes,
so
she does.
We'll be talking.
Although I must
more
say that my research as a reporter and what she does are completely separate entities, so
yeah.
I'm not trying to promote her here. I'm just trying to give you what I've learned.
No, I'm trying to promote her.
Okay.
But we're going to be talking with Laura about what are the actions that people can take to make sure that their immune system is supported and strong. The other thing I wanted to mention is that a lot of your work, John, you know, for many years it was sort of mapping out the system. But now your work, you're an artist, has really turned to the personal power and imagination. And I'd love at some point to have you back to talk about that. But we've posted at our blog for the Soleri Report Traditional Portfolio Strategy on this evening's session, we've posted the links to your websites, No More Fake News and TheMagicError.com.
Yep.
And you have audio seminars that go into the personal power and imagination work. And I just want to mention one of my favorites is Mind Control, Mind Freedom, which I always tell you I keep on my iPod. And whenever I'm in the airport, you know, they have the TV, CNN is blasting. And so I'll put my iPod in my ear and start to listen to Mind Control, Freedom, and just start to laugh. Because,
yeah,
you know, one is blaring out the official story, and the other is laying out the real story. And it's always, for me, it's always a marvelous thing to have the access to that information. So I encourage everybody to learn more about your work, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us on the Soleri Report.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
Have a good night, John.
Okay, good night.
Okay, next up is Let's Go to the Movies. The reason we have this segment is I found that one of the most effective vehicles for talking about what's going on and what we can do about it to be the movies. You know, it really is all in the movies. And Enemy of the State is one of my favorite movies. I watched it last night for, Lord, if I had to tell you how many times I've watched Enemy of the State, I'd be embarrassed because I used to call it my training film. Having spent many years in litigation with the federal government and having been involved in a period of physical harassment and surveillance and smear campaigns, it really resonates with me, and I learned a lot from watching it. I just wish it had come out a little bit sooner. Let's talk a little bit about Enemy of the State. For those who haven't watched you, it was made in 1998. It was directed by Tony Scott, who's one of my favorite directors. Tony and his brother Ridley Scott have made some of the best movies, I think, of a generation, and I encourage you to check out their movies if you really want to learn more about the real deal. It's a spy film, and it's the story of a group of NSA agents who kill a congressman who's blocking legislation that this group of NSA, this part of the NSA, wants to get passed. And then they try and cover up the murder by destroying evidence and intimidating some of the witnesses. And Will Smith is a Washington labor lawyer named Robert Dean. In fact, his office is a block away from where my office was in Washington. And he accidentally is, some of the evidence of the crime is put into one of his bags inadvertently, and he ends up being targeted by the NSA operation. And his ultimate redemption comes because he finds Gene Hackman, who plays a guy named Brill Lyle, who is a retired NSA agent who lives in a manner kind of hidden from the government, understands the NSA operations, and earns a living as a private investigator. So there are a couple of parts or points to the enemy of the state story that I want to talk about in terms of what the moral of the story is for us and what it means to the actions we can take. First, what we talked about last week in connection with the Bourne identity, and that is that there are no secrets. You watch an enemy of the state as information on people's bank accounts, on their phone calls, are accessed very quickly and integrated and sorted and looked at. And it's a reminder of the extraordinary level of access to information that a combination of satellites and information technology provide, particularly when you have massive government funding to support the infrastructure to collect, access, look at, manipulate, manage this kind of data. So again, we're in a society where, as a practical matter, we have to assume that there are no secrets. And the reason I keep saying that, and I want to underscore, is I still am amazed at how many people think that they can cut corners when it comes to laws and regulations because the information will be private. And I just want to stress that you should assume that whatever you do, whatever transactions you make, you should assume that they are public information and that they can be made visible very easily and very quickly. So that's point number one. Point number two is that the risks that government officials and business leaders are subject to are far greater than the average person understands. In Enemy of the State, we see a congressman who seems to be quite a decent, intelligent fellow say no to somebody lobbying them who has the power to kill. And when they don't do what the lobbyists want, they end up assassinated. And this is not out of, this is not an extreme thing. The people in Congress are subject to pressures from very powerful forces who have the ability to have a dramatic impact on your life. So, for example, I was a government official, and I and a group of, and then a private contractor who supported government officials, and you had a group of honest government officials in the way of the housing bubble and who were systematically driven out of Washington by the same kind of rogue operation that's described in Enemy of the State. So it's very important when you lobby your government officials or you communicate with your government officials that you understand the kind of pressures and risks that they face. John described the sort of his opinion on vaccines or on EPA policies with respect to fluoride. How could that happen? That can happen because you have many decades of government leaders subject to these kinds of pressures and oversight, even violent oversight. So if you want to know how these things can happen, they can happen because we, you know, the higher you go in the hierarchy, we live in a dangerous world. Message number three, which is sort of one of my favorite, you've probably heard me say before that our world is like Disney World. There's a world upstairs, and then beneath the surface, there's a world downstairs where a lot of the world upstairs is getting engineered. So there's the overt, and there's the covert. And what we see in Enemy of the State is we have this wonderful lawyer, Robert Dean, living a nice life in the overt world, and he's the master of his craft in the overt world. He gets hit by a covert operation, and he's completely lost and at the mercy of the people targeting him until he finds Brill, until he finds Gene Hackman, somebody who understands the covert world. And once they get their relationship sorted out and their ability to communicate sorted out, which is takes a little bit of doing, and it's been my experience as well, they integrate their knowledge and start to become effective and turn the tables on the other side. And the moral sort of that story is that if you look at the people centralizing economic and political power, they are very good at accessing and integrating and operating effectively between the overt and the covert world. And many of us have lived in the overt world, don't understand the covert world, and now as the world changes, one of the things we need to start to do is to understand that world and become effective at navigating a world where both can happen. And if you even extrapolate that point more, let me just say, as the economic bubble and the debt bubble, the air goes out of that bubble, we're all going to have to find new networks of people who have knowledge that we don't have. It's very easy in a bubble to be an expert at just one or a few things and just spend money to get and access everything else you need to know. Now we're moving into a world where money won't necessarily solve our problems, or the amount of money that we have is shrinking, and it is that much more important to have the network that we need, to have the knowledge that we need. So not only are we going to have to find a Brill, there are a lot of people that we're going to have to find, whether it's somebody, a nutritionist who really knows what's going on in the healthcare system, or just people to help us with our home. So think in terms of what is the knowledge I need to be successful in this changing environment, and how can I start to create that network? Okay, another very important point. It took my breath away when I first watched Enemy of the State. And you see a situation where here you have this lovely lawyer, Robert Dean, played by Will Smith, in Washington. He's a wonderful husband. He's a wonderful father. He's a wonderful provider. And within 24 hours, articles in newspapers that are not reputable have persuaded his own family that he is a criminal. And so anything that he says doesn't mean anything. The corporate media can literally control what the people around him think of him when there's no serious evidence of wrongdoing. And so you see, for example, the partners in his law firm saying that they've gotten a call. I mean, I can't tell you how many times during the litigation that happened to me, somebody would say, "Oh, well, I've had a call from somebody at the highest levels, higher than the White House, and you're really guilty." Of course, there's no evidence, there's no fact, and you spent a lifetime conducting yourself in an honorable manner, and yet this machinery can be turned on and suddenly you're not credible. Now, the thing to understand about this is really, who is your network? Who are you in business with? Who do you depend on in your day-to-day life? And are they the kind of people who will believe you or will believe the corporate media? Because to the extent that we can put as many degrees of separation between us and a media that's not trustworthy, the safer we are. And so as you think about your associations and your work and who you choose to associate with, the more you can associate with people who understand what's really going on and are not easily manipulated in the game of economic and political warfare, particularly by the corporate media, the safer you are. If for any reason many of us do have to go work inside the tapeworm or inside the system or deal with it, you want to be really cognizant of the fact that these kinds of things can happen, and so it is important to take care and to just be aware that these are the kinds of things that can happen. But anything you can do to build degrees of separation between you and not just the system, but people who absolutely believe in the system, the safer off we can be. One other thing that I wanted to mention, I sometimes refer to something called the Midianite thing, in reference to a story in the Bible in Judges about the story of Gideon. The Midianites were a group that had occupied Israel, and the way they were defeated was a series of things happened that caused them to fight among themselves. And so you'll hear me refer to the Midianite thing, where the pro-centralization starts fighting with each other. In Enemy of the State, one of the ways that Robert Dean, the Will Smith character, gets out of his problem is he manages to turn the mafia and the intelligence agencies on each other. They have a gunfight and kill each other off. The background on this story is, in fact, traditionally the mafia and the intelligence agencies have been very close, allies. And so in the story, you have groups that are traditional allies turning against each other or being turned against each other. And the reason I want to point that out is it's very important to remember that as the bubble drops and cash flows shrink, we're going to see a lot of factionalism and fighting on the pro-centralization team. And so expect the Midianite thing to happen and be cognizant that there is no they. In other words, whatever the machinery is that organizes around the government and central banking budgets and what I call the pro-centralization team, there are many, many factions, and as the cash flows shrink, there's going to be lots of squabbling. So be cognizant of the Midianite thing, and remember that there is no they. It's a very fractured, competitive system within it. So that's it for the movies. Again, if you're interested in us covering or watching any particular movies, do post them at the panel, or if you don't want to post on the subscriber panel, post them on the blog post for this evening's post. Next week we're not going to have a movie because we're doing our year-end wrap-up. In January we'll be watching Syriana and talking about Syriana, George Clooney's really fantastic movie, and the Godfather series. So if you feel like watching movies over the holiday, do watch Syriana and The Godfather in preparation for our discussion. Okay, looking ahead, it's the holiday season, so next Thursday is Christmas, so we won't be doing the Solari Report on Christmas evening, but we will be doing it the following evening on Friday, December 6th. That's my chance to do a year-end wrap-up. There are going to be no movies, no interviews. It's my assessment of what's happened in 2008, broad overview, what have been the big trends, and what does that mean to you, and what to look out for, and what are the actions you want to consider for 2009. Again, in January, we'll be covering Syriana and the Godfather series, so if you want to watch those over the holiday, that would be fantastic. Again, questions and feedback, put them on your panel or put them on the blog post if you want. And just in closing, let me say, thank you so much for being a subscriber to the Solari Report. It's a wonderful way for us to get and stay in cahoots with you. You are absolutely, you and yours are in our prayers during this holiday season. We look forward to talking to you the day after Christmas. And please remember, as you start to think about your New Year's resolutions, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. So good night. And good luck.